All rise. The Chief Judge and the Judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near. For the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good morning. What day is it? We're here to hear the case of United States versus Senior Airman St. Blanc. Major Hoyer, welcome. I understand you've reserved 5 minutes, is that correct?
Yes, Judge.
All right, and Captain McHugh, good morning.
Yes, ma'am, good morning.
Good morning, Captain Murkowski and Colonel Cordova.
Morning. Morning.
Major Hoyer, are you ready?
Yes, Judge.
You may.
Chief Judge Brand, Judge Helgett, Judge Gregory, may it please the court. How the government charges a case has consequences in terms of the maximum punishment. In this case, the government had options. The government could have charged the offense, the child pornography, what appears to be child pornography offense, under Clause 3 of Article 134, adopting the Title 18 offense, or it could have charged the offense as it did, under Clauses 1 and 2 of Article 134, and simply carried over every element from the Title 18 offense. It still would be a viable criminal offense to charge it under Clause 1 and 2 of 134 and leave out the element that the images depict actual minors. However, the maximum punishment would not be that from Title 18, from Title 18, Section 2252, of the Child Pornography Prevention Act of 1996. But the government did not charge it that way. It charged what appears to be minors. It did not charge the language from Title 18. It left out a substantive element, and therefore it is not authorized as per RCM 1003C1B2. It is not authorized to adopt the maximum punishment from the Title 18 offense. The foremost case discussing this issue as it relates to the Child Pornography Prevention Act, charged under Clauses 1 and 2 of Article 134, is our Superior Court's decision in U.S. v. Leonard. In that case, the specific holding of that case was, quote, the military judge did not err by referencing a directly analogous federal statute to identify the maximum punishment in the case when every element of the federal crime except the jurisdiction element was the same. Now, in Leonard, the contention by appellant in that case was that the interstate commerce element to create federal jurisdiction was missing, and therefore the government was not entitled to adopt the maximum punishment. Here, that element was missing as well. However, to be clear, appellant is not resting this issue on the jurisdictional element. It is resting it on the substantive element, which is, in this case, the charge says, appears to be. This is precisely the language that the Supreme Court in the Ashcroft v. Free Speech Coalition case in 2002 found to be unconstitutional. So here, the government has created an offense that is only an offense in the military. It is a uniquely military offense, yet it still wants to take the maximum punishment from the Title 18 offense that's in the statute as it has been amended to react to the Ashcroft decision.
Well, my question is, under Leonard, didn't talked about the gravamen of the offense. What's your position? What the gravamen of the offense in this case was?
Based on the entirety of the Leonard decision, specifically drawing from its holding, which I previously quoted. The gravamen means that every substantive element must be the same. And if this court were to find differently and go along the lines of what the government is arguing and saying essentially the same, the only authority that this court has for dropping a substantive element and still finding that the offenses are essentially the same is the Blevins case. That is a 1955 case decided in the height of the Red Scare where an Army private was convicted of violating the Smith Act. And in that case, the Smith Act, the statute required that the accused affiliate with an organization whose intent was to overthrow the government of the United States. That was never proven in that case. The court went through a very elaborate and tortured syllogism to get to that point, finding that Blevins affiliated with a communist group in East Germany, which was affiliated with the East German government, which was affiliated with the Soviet Union, which was affiliated with the International Communist Party, whose avowed intent was to overthrow the U.S. government. Blevins has never been followed, ever, to find that a substantive element can be lacking and the maximum punishment be adopted. It's a 1955 case, and the appellant submits that it can be limited to its facts involving an offense related to overthrow of the U.S. government.
Well, what about RCM 1003, which tells us to look to the code to find the most analogous? It doesn't say exactly the same, does it?
RCM 1003 C1B2, in terms of drawing from Title 18, says that an offense not listed in Part 4, the punitive section, and not included in or closely related to any offense listed therein is punishable as authorized by U.S. Code. 1003 C1B1 says, for an offense not listed in Part 4 of this manual, which is included in or closely related to an offense listed therein, the maximum punishment shall be of the offense listed.
So are you saying this isn't closely related?
Appellant submits that the offense here is not authorized for punishment in the U.S. Code and as determined by U.S. Leonard. What appellant submits the maximum punishment should be is that of service discrediting disorderly conduct, which carries a punishment of 4 months, because that is an offense included in the charged offense. Service discrediting disorderly conduct is included in the charged offense, and therefore under RCM 1003 C1B1, that should be the maximum punishment that the court should have found in this case. And I'll note to the court that the definition of disorderly conduct in the manual includes conduct that endangers public morals or outrages public decency. And I will, although not briefed, I will submit to the court United States v. Brinson, found in Title 49 of the Military Justice Reporter at page 360. That's a CAF decision from 1998, finding that service discrediting disorderly conduct was a lesser included offense of indecent language.
My question is kind of a follow-up on that, but more oriented toward notice pleading. What's your view on whether the specification as drafted is sufficient to give notice of what your appellant was supposed to defend against, especially given that apparently the appellant had an expert consultant which turned into a witness at trial and, in fact, helped the defense in determining which of the images were real and which were virtual. I guess my question under notice pleading jurisdiction, which we are, wouldn't this specification be sufficient to put the appellant on notice, especially given the apparently adequate or perhaps liberal discovery and the provision of an expert consultant slash witness?
Judge, pardon me, but my recollection of the facts of the case are a little bit different. I don't recall.
You could have it wrong.
I don't recall an expert witness testifying for the defense. I know they had an expert witness. I don't recall his testimony, if any.
Didn't she testify? Or
is it a Dr. Susan Brown.
Okay. All right. The correct. Yes. I was mistaken. I thought you were referring to a computer forensic expert.
No.
Okay.
The expert who helped identify which images were real and which were virtual, and
which were underage and
more. Right. And I assumed that individual had been a consultant. Properly appointed, because there was no issue on that, and then turned into an expert witness at trial.
Well, first, Judge, I would take issue with your characterization of the expert's testimony as whether they were real or virtual. I don't find that to be the case. What the doctor testified about was whether the images appeared to be minors. The forensics, the computer forensics of it, weren't involved in this at all. When you go through the record, you see that. The defense's contention throughout the case, because it was flowed from the charge. Their contention was that appellant did not download these images. The issue of whether the images were actual or virtual was not litigated at all.
Well, there was testimony that there were identifiable children in the pictures, known from the national basis.
Well, there were
databases.
There
right?
was testimony, Judge, that there were three NCMEC heads, but that wasn't elaborated at all. And in fact, the meaning of that wasn't even explained. And because the defense still had the opportunity to challenge that, but they had no need to or want to because the charge was appears to be. If the charge were actual, then they could have had an expert witness or expert consultant presumably discuss that with them and then possibly testify about it. But just like in Sendejas, which the government cites in its opposition to oral argument for the proposition that this issue is moot, stands for precisely the opposite. In Sendejas, CAF overturned the Army Court decision when the Army Court went back and did a fact-finding to find that some of the images were, in fact, real. And this was one of those group of cases that were decided pre-Ashcroft and then went on appeal after Ashcroft. Now, the pre-Ashcroft language of the statute included the is or appears to be. So there was an appellate issue over whether the findings were based on the is or the appears to be. So if there was enough of a record, if it was fully and fairly litigated, that's the language Sendejas uses, the appellate court could go back and find that there were actual victims, actual children depicted in the images. However, we don't have a fully and fairly litigated developed record at that point because of the charge. The case was litigated based on the charge. It appears to be the issue of virtual or actual didn't come up. Ultimately, what the government proposes here in adopting the gravamen-type test is an unworkable standard. First, if the court would agree with that here, it would set clear precedent that would allow for mischief at the trial level by the government taking a Title 18 offense, dropping out one, maybe two elements, maybe more, and saying, well, it's still essentially the same, so we're going to adopt the maximum punishment. But an even greater concern is on the administration of justice at the trial level because, and this goes back to the notice question by Judge Gregory earlier, the parties, especially the accused, will not know what the maximum punishment is until the findings are in, based on the evidence that's presented and the specific findings. And if we have a member's case, that gets very complicated. If we have a guilty plea where all we have is the care inquiry, it gets very complicated. It's setting this up to be a separately litigated issue whenever we have clause one or two offenses under Article 134, and it's much easier to go where Leonard was heading and find that if you're going to adopt the Title 18 maximum punishment, you need to charge and prove all the substantive elements. Keep in mind that the government can still charge this offense. It can still charge clause one or two under 134 as what appears to be, but it just can't adopt the maximum punishment from Title 18.
Well, isn't this maximum punishment the same if it had been an attempt rather than an actual crime under Title 18?
Yes, Judge. If it was attempted possession of actual images, actual minors.
What's your authority for your position?
U.S. v. Leonard and the holding in that case.
Well, the holding in that case applied to actual. I mean, what case has said if the charge appears to be, then you have to call it disorderly conduct?
None. This issue is before the court or any court, to my knowledge, for the first time. So we rely on U.S. v. Leonard and the language of RCM 1003 C1B2.
You're not raising ineffective assistance of counsel, are you?
Not at all, Judge. This issue possibly could be raised under ineffective assistance of counsel. In fact, it was raised under both an improvident plea standard and a IAC standard analyzed and raised separately in a case that the government cites in its answer to the assignment of errors in this case. In the Fernando Garcia case, the court analyzed it under both, and an appellant in this case has not raised ineffective assistance of counsel.
I guess I asked that just to go back to the the notice thing, and I don't mean to beat that to death, but it appears that the appellant at trial was advised by his counsel that this would carry the maximum punishment that everyone discussed at trial.
Exactly, Judge, and that's why his forum election was not knowing and intelligent, and if you will, an improvident forum election. If, of course, this issue is predicated on this court finding an appellant's favor in the first issue, but if the maximum punishment was only 4 months for the appears to be child pornography specification, that completely changes the dynamic of forum selection. It takes away the whole issue of getting a massive sentence in front of members, but it militates in favor of the accused taking his chances in front of a panel, which would be a greater chance, as he states in his declaration, of a full acquittal and avoiding being a sex offender for the rest of his life.
That's what I'm confused on. In the appellant's declaration, he talks about had he been advised what the maximum punishment would be, that he would have chosen a different form. Yet you're not raising ineffective assistance of counsel, and his counsel clearly advised them that they felt that the maximum punishment would be what with the CPA, the 10 years. In fact, I think they even said it might have been 20 under the CPPA. So I guess I'm trying to understand, and just earlier you argued that, you know, we have to wait until findings to determine what the maximum punishment is. So if we're going to wait till findings, then how does the appellant choose his form selection? Because you can't wait till findings for that.
Well, to address the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, which seems to be the first part of your question, Judge, the appellant suggests that the court address this issue as analogous to those cases in which all parties were, including defense counsel from the beginning in advice to appellant, were under a misapprehension of the maximum punishment. There are plenty of those cases, including those cited in appellant's assignment of errors, such as U.S. v. Hardin, U.S. v. Poole. In those cases, when all parties, including defense counsel, were under misapprehension of the maximum punishment, and the issue was whether the guilty plea, was provident, that was addressed under an knowing and intelligent waiver standard. And here, we're dealing, likewise, with a constitutional right to a jury trial, which is also embodied in statute at 10 U.S.C. 816 and Article 16 of the UCMJ of the right to a panel. We're dealing with a commensurate right, a waiver of that. So it should also be judged under knowing intelligent waiver. And if the courts are going to look at knowing intelligent waiver of a guilty plea when defense counsel misadvised appellant in that situation, it should likewise address this issue as a knowing and intelligent waiver rather than ineffective assistance of counsel. And there are a couple cases, and I'll bring one to the court's attention with this issue. IAC versus knowing intelligent waiver was directly addressed. It's discussed in U.S. v. Smith, which is an Army opinion from 1985, found at volume 21 of the Military Justice Reporter at 642. At page 644, it says, I don't have the direct quote with me, but it discusses whether the issue should be addressed under ineffective assistance of counsel, which defense counsel did not raise in that case, and it concludes that it should be addressed under the knowing and intelligent waiver standard. And I apologize, Judge, did that address your question in totality?
For the IEC, now what about the form selection?
The form selection, well, again, this goes back to his declaration. If you look at the totality of the circumstances in this case, of course, predicated on finding that he was misadvised, if he knew that the actual maximum punishment was only 4 months, which drastically reduced his criminal exposure, then he would have taken his chances and gone for the full acquittal and avoided being a sex offender and taking his chances in front of a panel, whether of officer or officer and enlisted. And as Your Honor indicates, the defense counsel admits in their declarations that they did, in fact, misadvise appellant of the maximum punishment in this case. So the factual circumstances are really not at issue here. If you look at the standard set forth by U.S. v. Poole, in looking at this issue in terms of a provident plea when all parties are under misapprehension of the maximum punishment, Poole says, quote, we look to all the circumstances presented by the record to determine whether misapprehension of the maximum sentence affected the guilty plea or whether the factor was insubstantial in his decision to plead. Here, it affected the forum choice decision, and it was, as indicated in his declaration, a substantial part of his decision to go judge alone.
I don't have that declaration with me. Did the defense counsel offer a reason as to why they misapprehended, as you say, the maximum?
They cite to, I believe, Title 18, and I know for the record, a note to the court, that in the record there is no discussion at all about how the judge arrived at the maximum punishment. We can assume safely, I believe, that the judge adopted it from Section 2252A4, which is the 10 years for possession of child pornography, and you add that to the 2 years for the other offense for which appellant was convicted, which was the attempt in indecent language, you get to 12, which is what the judge stated on the record. So in the end, under U.S. v. Leonard and RCM 1003C1B1, the government in this case may not drop a substantive element, create a uniquely military offense, yet still take advantage of the maximum punishment. Not only create a uniquely military offense, but lower its burden of proof. By the same token, had appellant been, or all parties, including all parties to the case, had appellant been aware that that was the actual maximum punishment in this case, he would have elected a different form. So his election, his decision to go judge alone in this case, was not made knowingly and intelligently. Therefore, the findings in the sentence must be set aside. Thank you.
Dr. Murkowski.
May it please the court. I am Captain Michael Rutkowski, and along with Colonel Douglas Cordova, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge did not commit plain error, and appellant's counsel were not ineffective, as each calculated the correct maximum punishment for appellant's crimes under the law. Moreover, appellant's current appeal to this court on quote-unquote virtual child pornography grounds is completely irrelevant, as he was convicted of possessing actual images of minors based on the evidence introduced at his trial. This was not contested at trial, and our Superior Court has never made a distinction between actual images and those not proven as actual in a Clause 1 and 2 prosecution. First, turning to Issue 1, appellant is correct. United States v. Leonard is the opinion that is most relevant to this case and that you should rely on. However, his statement of the holding in that case is not entirely correct. United States v. Leonard, CAF made it clear that a maximum punishment for a Clause 1 and 2 prosecution under Article 134, you use the maximum punishment from the applicable section of the CPPA. As stated, that's based on RCM 1003C1B2 and the fact that when there is no specific offense listed in the MCM for a Article 134 general article, we use the closest article from the United States Code. In this case, that is precisely what the CPPA is. Clause 1 and 2 prosecution is what we had in Leonard. It was for child pornography, and CAF found that to be appropriate, even though the specification was missing an element from the CPPA. They specifically stated, neither Clause 1 nor Clause 2 requires that the specification exactly match the elements of conduct prescribed by federal law. Appellant attempts to make the distinction based on jurisdictional grounds, relying on one sentence from Leonard. The government would ask that you read the language before and after that sentence and not strictly rely on one statement. The holding in that case said, we focus not simply on jurisdictional, but on whether the offense charge is essentially the same in the specification and in the federal law.
Well, would you agree that actual minors versus computer-generated minors, there's a huge difference?
Under Sendejas and Brisbane, Your Honor, no, we would not. CAF has stated that they don't see a distinction between the two. Specifically under Mason, they said the distinction between actual child pornography and virtual child pornography does not alter the character of the appellant's conduct as either service discrediting or prejudicial good order and discipline. And United States v. Mason was 60 MJ 15 cited in our supplemental citation of authority to this court. In Leonard, they stated that to determine the essentially the same between the specification and the federal offense, we determine whether the two offenses prescribe the same criminal conduct and same mens rea. In this case, they found the Clause 1 and 2 prosecution in Leonard did involve the same criminal conduct and same mens rea as the CPPA. Therefore, the two offenses were essentially the same, and use of the CPPA to determine maximum punishment was appropriate. Leonard is the controlling case in this case and is based on good reasoning and good law. It is based on Jackson and Blevins and other Article 134 sentencing cases determined prior to it. Since Leonard, five CCA opinions have used Leonard at least as a reference for determining what the maximum punishment is for a Clause 1 and 2 child pornography case, including Snook and Dunn, two cases from our sister court of the Marines, specifically rejecting this four-month argument that appellant is raising right here. Those cases, while Snook argued that a jurisdictional element was different, Dunn just simply argued, as appellant argues, that the service discrediting of disorderly conduct was more appropriate, and the Marines specifically rejected that argument.
But those cases didn't deal with what appears to be.
Your Honor, I'd have to go and check the language of those cases to see if they did. But moreover, we would argue just simply stating appears to be does not end the whole discussion right there. The Supreme Court held that appears to be is overbroad in that it encompassed both actual child pornography and images that could be computer generated or could be 18-year-olds dressing up to look younger, and said that in civilian society that was inappropriate. Sandeas and Brisbane have said that we can charge that in the military because it's still service discrediting and prejudicial good order and discipline conduct. In this case, moving to our second part of Issue 1, we had proof of actual minors. So the entire issue, even if there is a legitimate argument to make there, is completely moot when it comes to appellant's facts.
But that's not what was being charged.
Your Honor,
you only have to look at what was actually charged. I mean, if you charge something and you prove, charge an LIO and you prove a greater offense, the max is still going to be the max for the LIO.
Your Honor, we would disagree as to whether it was an LIO or a greater offense. By charging appears to be, basically under the language of Ashcroft, Sandeas, and Brisbane, the government is putting the defense on notice that these images could contain actual child pornography as well as computer-generated images or anything else that would fall under the quote-unquote virtual child pornography. Here, besides three images that the defense expert said she couldn't tell for sure if they were 18-year-olds or under 18, there was no allegations that the 15 images he was convicted of or the four videos he's convicted of were not actual children. To the extent that it was actually brought up at trial, all parties essentially treated these as images of actual children. And appellant's defense to those images was not on any kind of virtual grounds or computer-generated grounds, but his defense was either he didn't download them or he must have innocently downloaded them. Along with that, as this court has already stated, the government's experts stated that we had confirmed images of known child victims when compared to the NCMEC database, and the appellant's experts stated she had no age determination questions with the other images that he was actually convicted of.
What if the expert had testified that all of the images were virtual as opposed to real? How does that affect your position regarding the specification and the maximum punishment?
Your Honor, as appellant has stated, there has been no decision yet from our Superior Court that has stated that virtual is somehow punished less severely than actual if we are talking of virtual. Again,
you think the same max would apply?
Your Honor, based on Mason, the language in Mason, yes, we would. Mason, as I stated, there is no distinction when it comes to the character of the appellant's conduct, whether it's actual or virtual. All the opinions post-Ashcroft from our Superior Court, I believe there's about 14 child pornography type opinions that have been published by CAF since then, not a single one of them for a Clause 1 or 2 offense has found that quote-unquote virtual child pornography is any different than actual child pornography for the sakes of criminal prosecutions in the military.
And assuming, as I mentioned to Major Hoyer, that there was sufficient discovery and availability of experts, your position is that this specification as drafted is sufficient to put the accused on notice of both actual and virtual possession, and depending on how the proof shakes out, it would not affect the maximum punishment anyway.
Correct, Your Honor. The only scenario that would affect what the maximum punishment would be is if you were to adopt appellant's argument that somehow it should be 4 months with no case law or authority to support that argument. under the government's argument and under the superior decisions from our superior court, it's always treated as the same. So no matter what, it would always be the same punishment under Clause 1 and 2. Obviously, under Clause 3, that would be a separate scenario, and that's what Sandeas held. And I would like to point out that appellant summary of Sandeas, that the Superior Court stated that the service court wasn't allowed to go in and determine this. That was because it was a Clause 3 prosecution. Clause 1 and 2 prosecutions since then, Sandeas specifically states the fact finder can determine if there's actual images based on review of the images alone, and that includes, under appropriate circumstances, a service court of appeals. In this case, under your Article 66 review, determine factual sufficiency, and since this is specifically being raised on appeal and was not raised at trial, we would contend that it is appropriate for this court to review the images and review the evidence and determine if there are actual images, if they feel there would be a distinction between actual and those not proven to be actual, although the government does contend that there is no such distinction based on any case law we can find.
Well, what the appellant seems to be saying is that when the government charges what appears to be, that is a really a lesser standard than actually in terms of proof of what they have to prove than charging actual. They are, and the government must have been looking at their evidence and determined that they were going to charge something. Well, why should we have to prove, you know, that they are children? Well, we can just say what appears to be, and if you're going to do that, government, then the maximum punishment should be less because of what you're having to prove is less. So are you trying to tell us that you believe that doesn't matter what the government charged, what appears to be, or they are actual children, that they should be entitled to the same maximum punishment?
I'm stating, Your Honor, that under our decisions from our Superior Court, that appears to be what they're holding. Sandeas specifically said no burden on the government to prove images are actual children in a Clause 1 or 2 prosecution. We have had no guidance that says we're going to somehow treat these as differently. The only guidance we've had says treat them the same. Based on the language in Ashcroft, Sandeas, and Brisbane, we would argue that appears to be puts them on notice of both and that the punishment is the same for either one. In this case, it actually, under the facts of this case, doesn't matter because he was proven guilty of actual images. The judge found him not guilty of the three images they contested, and everything else was not contested as an actual child or not.
And the not guilties were based on an age determination as opposed to virtual versus real, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And the term virtual, it's a tricky term because sometimes they use it for age determination,
right.
Sometimes computer generated. In this case, I think the better determinations are actual and those proven to be actual. In this case, she found him not guilty of three images that there was some question as to whether they were actual or not.
I thought the question was their age, not whether it was actual or not.
Correct, Your Honor. I suppose I misstated there. Defense expert did
actual
specify.
Minors.
Yes, Your Honor. Actual minors is probably the best correct. The defense expert didn't state they were not minors. She just simply stated that she couldn't be tell based on a development of breast tissue and other items, basically Tanner staging, that they could be 18, they could be 15. She wasn't sure.
I understand, but that doesn't address virtual or appears to be versus actual children.
Your Honor, and that's why the government hesitates to use the term virtual because some courts have used virtual for what have been proven to be not minors and others that we have just have not proved up that they were minors. It's a term that is used interchangeably, unfortunately not a great term of art, I believe.
Was any of the evidence provided to the appellant or presented at trial that you're aware of actually deal with virtual?
Not that anything in the record indicates, Your Honor. Essentially, this is an entirely new claim on appeal. Nothing even in appellant's clemency submission stated that this was somehow an issue. It essentially come up just before this court. There are no further questions on Issue 1. I'll briefly turn to Issue 2. In this case, appellant is claiming that they are not alleging ineffective assistance of counsel, but the gist of what they're stating is essentially an allegation of an ineffective assistance of counsel. If I may briefly go over it, appellant's alleging he was misadvised of a pertinent fact under the law, and that caused him to waive a constitutional right he wouldn't have otherwise waived, and based on this misadvice that caused him to waive this right, he's asking you to set aside his entire conviction and sentence. While they may not use the terms ineffective assistance of counsel, that's essentially the definition of an ineffective assistance of counsel allegation. It's as such, the government argues that Strickland and Polk are the correct standards to use to review this allegation. And even if this court was to look at the substantial basis standard that the appellant is proposing, in here there is no substantial basis standard based on appellant's affidavit alone. Appellant states he was advised by his counsel that he could face up to 10 years for the child pornography specification, and in this case the military judge used the 10 years as the maximum possible punishment.
How do you address Major Hoyer's reference to the several guilty plea cases where everybody at the trial level was under the misapprehension of the correct maximum, and that wasn't decided on ineffective assistance, was it?
No, Your Honor. The one that's actually cited in their brief that Major Hoyer discussed was United States v. Poole.
In that case, the military judge grossly overstated the maximum during the trial in a guilty plea case, so there would be a maximum punishment inquiry. This case, there was no requirement for maximum punishment inquiry. The trial counsel merely asked the judge to go ahead and do it, and there was no objection from defense counsel when it was stated. But as far as Poole, they specifically stated that the issue on appeal is not whether the appellant would change his election now. It is whether there is a reasonable likelihood, based on the record, he would have done a different election at trial if he had been advised differently. In this case, based on all the affidavits and the information submitted to this court, the government argues there is no reasonable likelihood he would have changed. It's very clear in the appellant's affidavit and the affidavits of counsel, his main concern with judge jury was, who's going to give me the worst sentence? And he was very concerned that the jury would be inflamed by seeing images of child pornography, seeing these indecent chats he was having with who he thought was a 13-year-old girl at the time, and would give him a more severe sentence. I believe appellant, in his affidavit, specifically states, I fear that a jury could punish me more severely than what my attorneys explained to me was the predictable sentence I would get before the judge.
But that was based on a 10-year maximum for this offense, and if it was a 4-year maximum with 2 years for the conversations, that changes the whole landscape, and the maximum that the counsel would be advising the client of would reasonably be less, correct?
Your Honor, and we would want to clarify on the numbers. Prior to trial, he faced another specification which carried with it 7 years. So at the time he's making his election, whether I'm going to go with a military judge or with a jury, he's facing a 9-year and, in his mind, 8-month time period, essentially 10 years, whereas he ended up facing 12 at the end of the day when he was convicted on the two offenses. So he was sentenced to 2 years after he faced a 9-year and 8-month period. The government would argue, based on all the evidence in the record and based on the affidavits submitted to this court post-trial, there's nothing to say that there's a reasonable likelihood he would have changed his mind, even if he had been told that the child pornography offenses only carried 4 months. If there's no further questions, may I briefly conclude? The military judge should not commit plain error in this case, and both defense counsel were effective in their representation of appellant because, under United States v. Leonard and all the precedents we have from our superior court, the CPPA is the correct and directly analogous federal statute for determining maximum punishment in a Clause 1 and 2 child pornography case. I will note that the directly analogous language comes directly from Leonard and Jackson and Blevins. It's not stated in RCM, but it's how our superior court has interpreted the RCM. Moreover, appellant's mere disagreement with the state of the law is not legitimate grounds to break from controlling precedent. As such, this court should affirm the findings and the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Major Hoyer.
The government stated that appellant was convicted of actual images. That's simply not the case. It segues into another issue here, which is the Sendejas case, which appellant submits the government has totally mischaracterized. Sendejas was tried pre-Ashcroft, went on appeal after Ashcroft. It was evaluated at trial under the is or appears to be standard. In that case, the findings did not contain enough of a record, CAF found, for the Army Court to go back and find that there were actual depictions, that the judge relied on actual depictions. The same case here, the findings do not indicate which of the images the judge found to contain actual minors. Moreover, the language from Sendejas is that the issue must be fully and fairly litigated below. And of course, it wasn't. Why not? Because it wasn't charged. It wasn't litigated. The government did not put on any evidence to prove that these were actual victims. So the defense, therefore, did not have to defend against it. So we don't have a fully and fairly litigated, developed record.
Well, let me ask this question. What appears to be has been characterized really by both parties as virtual. But is it limited to just virtual? I mean, what appears to be a child could be somebody who actually is a child, but it was really trying to find child porn, and in the mix of everything, you got a couple images that weren't, right? But, I mean, why is it, here's my question, is what appears to be only applied to virtual?
Yes, Judge. Yes, it would what appears to be child I would say virtual applies to anything that is not an actual victim but appears to be child pornography, which has been found to be unconstitutional for whatever reason, virtual or as of age or adults dressing up to look young that appear to be minors. That was what was found to be unconstitutional. And that's what was charged and proved here.
I guess I'm still riding my notice horse. Appears to be, could be virtual, appears to be, could be real kids. And given the discovery and the obvious availability of experts, why couldn't appears to be include virtual, real kids that might be over 18, as the expert apparently testified, or real kids that are under 18.
The problem, Judge, is we don't know the difference. And the issue wasn't litigated. The government didn't prove that. Of course, it could, but the government needs to prove that if it wants to take the Title 18 offense. What you're saying, Judge, what you've described is still an offense. It's still a crime. It's still being charged and convicted and punished, but you just can't take the Title 18 maximum punishment over.
Well, staying with that theory of notice, was there any evidence presented at trial of the child pornography that dealt with virtual children?
No, none. It didn't come off.
So virtual was never really an issue in this trial, was it?
It wasn't an issue because it wasn't charged.
You just told me what appears is virtual, so you're telling me it was charged. So I'm trying to find out what the evidence that was presented, whether or not it was charged, what the evidence that was presented, was any of it virtual?
Oh, pardon me, I understand your question now. We don't know because it wasn't an issue at the trial.
Well, what did Dr. Brown talk about? Yeah.
She talked about whether the victims appeared to be minors, not whether they were virtual. That's what we're dealing with. On one side, we have a pediatrician forensic issue, and what we're talking about here is a computer forensic issue. To get a computer forensic expert to go in there looking at the hashes and the history and the technical things that to show that whether the image had been altered at all. That's what the virtual part of this is about. Finally, the government still insists, despite the analogous cases, to wanting to address this case under the ineffective assistance of counsel standard. The appellant notes that there's absolutely no authority for addressing this issue under ineffective assistance of counsel, and all the analogous cases point in the other direction. In addition, the government stated that there was no requirement for maximum punishment in this case. Well, in fact, you know, it's on record, even in a litigated case, when it comes to sentencing, the judge must state what the maximum punishment is, and that's how we know that the judge miscalculated it in this case. If there are no other further questions, I'll end. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the arguments. We will be issuing our decision in due course. Court is adjourned.
All rise.